The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We are on iTunes, we're on Amazon, we're on Stitcher, other podcast platforms under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook, Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Twitter, WOWKUCIFM. Our websites, Barbara's is Pen on Fire. Mine is mariestone.com. There is information on past shows, speaker series events. We've got all of our archives up there. So there's a lot of information up there where you can find us both. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. Today, we're going back to nonfiction, narrative nonfiction, which isn't something we do a tremendous amount of on the show, but I love it when we do. This book was straight up my own childhood memory alley. The book is Come Fly the World, about Pan Am stewardesses, as they were known back then in the mid-20th century. My mom was a stewardess and then a flight attendant, and my dad was a pilot. So not only was this fun and informative and in many ways not what you'd think, but it's also kind of a walk down memory lane for me. I'm going to give you a super abbreviated version of Julia Cook's bio, but hopefully we get to talk about a lot of it in more detail. Her journalism has been published in Time, Smithsonian, Condé Nast Traveler. Julia is the author of The Other Side of Paradise, Life in the New Cuba, and the daughter of a former Pan Am executive. She has a BA from Georgetown and an MFA from Columbia University. Come Fly the World is published by Houghton Mifflin. It's the subject of our chat this morning. Julia, welcome.
Hi.
So before we dive into the book, I alluded to a big journalism bio, but I thought we could just start by you talking about how you got your start in journalism and kind of your road into writing, and we can take off from there, so to speak.
Yeah, I got my start in journalism intellectually. It was when I studied abroad in Havana, Cuba. It was the first place that I had been to that, you know, really ignited a sense in me that I wanted to write about it and have that writing published. I had always written in journals. I'd written some poetry. I worked on the student newspaper at Georgetown. And, you know, I had never really had a sense of mission kind of about it, or, you know, a real sense of urgency, I guess. Urgency is a much better word. And then I lived in Cuba for 4 months, and I had this distinct feeling that place that I was living in really bore so little resemblance to what I had read about it. It was the first place where the journalism that I had read didn't match what I was experiencing. And so I really wanted to contribute to that. So after college, I moved to Mexico City. I highly encourage anyone who is interested in journalism and, you know, in your early 20s to move abroad. There are lots of good jobs to be had for people who have any inclination for teaching English, and you can publish what you can by seeing, just going someplace and observing and letting your interests guide you. That's at least what I did. And it was really fun and kind of trial by fire in terms of trying to place pieces back in the States, which sometimes went really well and sometimes did not go at all. But yeah, that's how it all started.
And it sounds like you've really made a career life for yourself in this intersection between travel and travel and architecture, but also travel and women's issues. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of writing done at that juncture.
Yeah, there is. It's interesting. I was trying to explain the other day to someone that I found myself, I think if I look back at what I've written, most of it is kind of animated by a sense of wanting to understand how people are shaped by their culture and how they shape their culture. And, you know, that culture can sometimes be, you know, the overriding culture of a place, as in society. But it also has been at many times culture, as in art, architecture, writing also. So that's been, I tend to really just follow my instincts and my interests.
And it's so different to write, I'm sure it's so different to write a book length piece versus an article. And so we can talk about that a little bit more later. But yeah, wrapping your mind around different size projects, the architecture of those projects feels so different.
It's so different. And the strategies are so different. And yet, you know, there are similarities in that a book length piece, or at least my books, have been kind of a collection of different stories that come together and are stitched together. So there are similarities, but it's also just a lot more complicated and fun.
So let's dive in. I'm going to let you introduce the book because you're going to do a better job than I am. But take us into Come Fly the World and kind of your inspiration for writing it, and then we can dive in.
So my inspiration for writing it actually comes from my architecture writing in a way, because I was living in New York in, you know, I think it was 2014, and I had always wanted to go tour the Aeroceran and TWA terminal. This was before it had become a hotel. And I saw that the Pan Am Historical Foundation was hosting an event there. So I went to the event and I found myself chatting with these women who had been former Pan Am stewardesses. And I was just completely entranced by them. They were ebullient and interesting. And they talked about history as if they had martinis with prime ministers and spies and soldiers and, you know, movie stars. They talked about the world with this sense of intimacy and ownership that I found electrifying. And as I was reflecting on our, you know, the afternoon that we'd spent together, I was surprised at how unbelievably knowledgeable they've been. And then I was kind of chastising myself for that surprise. I kept thinking, you know, why wouldn't they be so knowledgeable? And why wouldn't they talk about the world as if they kind of owned it? Because in a sense, they did. And so I decided to dig in a little bit, that sense of surprise. And I wanted to understand why I had been kind of convinced by the stereotyping around stewardesses that, you know, that the job was somehow unserious, especially mid-century stewardesses, that it had more to do with, you know, tourism and shopping than it did with really a deep understanding of the world and how it functioned, and a sense of almost pseudo-diplomacy. These women had to work on their feet, both literally and metaphorically. They had to think on their feet. They had to adapt to really dramatic and important circumstances. And they did it with panache. And anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. I really wanted to find out more. That's what animated the book.
I know why you were, or I can guess why you would fall into those stereotypes, because I fell into them too when I grew up in that world. So, I mean, the stereotypes were so prevalent and pervasive, and somewhat, you know, there is that side of it. So I can see where it came from. Yeah.
And I came to view that side of it very differently. After spending so much time with these women and interviewing them, I really came to understand, you know, the shopping that they did in a very different way, as, you know, an expression of agency and, you know, an ability to remind themselves of their place in the world, as much as, you know, it was just shopping for shopping's sake. So,
right,
you know,
right.
even those stereotypes really are shaped by stereotypes, if that makes sense.
No, it does. Well, we should point out to listeners who haven't, I know they haven't yet picked up the book, because it's not out yet, but that it really is a book about history and about what the 20th century, the mid 20th century, the geopolitical situation of the world, a lot about Vietnam, a lot about women's rights and feminism, a lot about Black and racial rights. So it's a surprise. I mean, I think it would be selling the book a little short, a really short, to just say it's a book about, you know, stewardesses in the 1950s, because it's about so much. And does that sound like a mission statement when you went into it? Or was that a surprise that kind of unveiled itself over time as you were doing the research?
It really did. It unveiled itself over time. The more I got to know these women, the more I understood the degree to which these huge currents that were moving through American society and global the world at the time. This was an era that had just seen massive decolonization of many of the countries around the world. So there were these new republics that were figuring out who they were, how they wanted to interact with the capitalism versus communism in the Cold War. There were these new flight technologies that were navigating around that world and you know, jetting into these different countries that were brand new and trying to figure out their relationships with each other. And there were these women who were crewing these flights. And then back home, there was the Vietnam protest movement. There was the civil rights movement. There were these huge movements that would go on to shape American society moving forward. And so the more I talked to these women, the more I understood that, you know, each plane was a microcosm in a way of all of those different changes that were running through. And so these women were all over and over again behaving in ways that refracted those movements and those changes. And over time, those changes really changed them.
So tell me a little bit about finding these women. I'm trying to think of the cast of characters as, like, we follow kind of four or five, six of them kind of pretty closely.
There are
Trying to
five.
mentally calculate how many there were.
there are three primary women who come together at the end, and then two other women who are really important to the story as well. You know, I found them all via just going to these different events that are hosted by both the Pan Am Historical Foundation and the Association of Former Flight Crew, which is called World Wings International. So I just became this kind of, I would just go to these conferences and luncheons, and you know, the youngest by about 40 years, maybe 30. You know, some of them brought along their daughters also, so I was not always the only one there in my 30s. But I went to these events and I just talked to women, and you know, one by one, they connected me with other women. They're all very generous with their time. They were really excited, I think, that someone was taking their stories seriously and really trying to put their stories into the proper historical, sociopolitical context. And so they were, you know, for the most part, and most of the women were really excited to connect me with other women who had really incredible stories to tell. So, you know, they were kind of their own best ambassadors, which makes sense. And yeah, that's how I found the women.
How many did you start with in kind of a pool, and then tell me about the winnowing down process of focusing on these particular three to five?
So the winnowing down process was two-pronged. On the one hand, it really had to do with who was interested in talking to me as much as I wanted to talk to them on some level. It was a lot of different women, and I pretty naturally and quickly learned that some of their memories were more detailed than the others. Some of them were more willing to just talk to me over and over and over again to try to, you know, get as much texture from their memories and as much, you know, reflection on their experiences as I could. And you know, they were telling me a lot about their lives before Pan Am and around Pan Am and after Pan Am as well. So there are only so many people who are really willing to dive into that kind of relationship with a writer. So that had a lot to do with it. Their memories had a lot to do with it. But also, I realized at some point that one of the things that I was most interested in was these war flights. And I was interested in the civil rights movement. I was interested in the feminist movement. And so the people whose stories told that story, those larger stories, drew me in the most.
Well, and I always enjoy talking about I always say it's the world the book is born into, but the publishing timing of this is relevant in a number of ways. A, I haven't been on an airplane in a year, so it was very fun to have this born into a world where people haven't been traveling and I think are so hungry to travel. And so on a selfish level, this was just a ton of fun to get to go to all these places again mentally, you know, in the last days that I've been reading it. So that was great. But also, you know, I think history repeats itself, and I think we're at a time when a lot of these issues are being revisited, and you know, the racial tensions are obviously very high. The conversation about communism versus capitalism is again very high. You know, we're at such a volatile flashpoint, you know, in a variety of ways, that this book really spoke to both a reminder that, you know, we've been through hard things before and some resonance. And I don't know if that was kind of knocking around in your head when you did it, or it was kind of fortuitous timing, but I don't know if you are thinking about the book in the relationship to where it is coming out now as opposed to what was happening back then.
It's so interesting because what I was thinking about when I started writing the book, now that was 2014 when I started researching and talking to these women. And it was animated by a very different sense of resonance with the present moment back then. You know, that was Obama. We were looking at Hillary Clinton was, you know, starting to launch her campaign and so ascendant in early 2016. And I had a real sense of what I was excited to dig into was, honestly, I was really interested in looking at how the binaries that I felt still acted on women were kept in place, and how these women kind of broke those down, the binaries between feminism and femininity. And you know, the binaries between this concept of either you're invested in your family and you're staying home, or you're traveling a lot and you're out in the world. And those were, you know, anxieties that I had for myself and that I felt, you know, in my early 30s. And so I really wanted to understand how this group of women navigated all of that and how they seemed to break down those binaries and seem to really forge a path between what, you know, society wants us to keep very separate. So it's interesting to hear that the ways in which you feel like it resonates with the present day, because I can see that, and I can see how in the writing and, you know, reacting to the changes that are happening through American society and global society, it really impacted what wound up getting focused on and writing. But what inspired it was actually totally different.
That is funny. Well, we should say that, I mean, the difference between the Pan Am flight attendant and sort of the other garden variety flight attendants, I hadn't realized. I mean, so much of this book was so illuminating to me about the very strict requirements of, you know, language fluency. A lot of these women had gone to grad school when most women at that point hadn't gone to college. Just what the qualifications were to be a Pan Am flight attendant. I wonder if you can kind of break down some of those stereotypes, because I feel like I was a little shocked.
They were unbelievably well prepared. I think it was my dad who said that, who worked for Pan Am, and he said, well, and I know that he worked for Pan Am, but I think it was he who said that Pan Am had the most overqualified flight crew of any group of employees in the world. The flight crews all spoke two languages. So all flight crews on any airline in the 60s it was predominantly women. They were all subjected to really rigorous, strict, and deeply sexist height and weight requirements. They were, you know, discussed in their, I think that they were, their physical appearances were dissected in their interview sessions, really in excruciating detail, you know, and excruciating and deeply sexist detail.
Yeah.
They were, you know, back in the early mid 60s, women were discussed in really, in racist terms, and in their physical appearances were just scrutinized if they wanted to be on these flight crews. But in addition to all of that, being under 26, single, beautiful, a specific height and weight, women on Pan Am also had to speak two languages with proficiently and have at least some college education. And, you know, that was the baseline. In reality, I think it's 10%, 10 to 15% of them had graduate degrees. And the number of women who graduated from college at all in America at the time was far below that. These were women who were just so overqualified, whose families really, a lot of their families were pretty chagrined when they decided to become stewardesses. But really, there was no better way to be assured that you were going to be able to travel to places that you wanted to travel to and get paid to do it. And, you know, Pan Am being what it was, the only airline that, you know, flew exclusively international routes in the U.S., they really got an incredible cross-section of, you know, the most important people in the U.S. or around the world, really, at the time. They had diplomats and politicians and musicians and Elvis and Elizabeth Taylor and the Beatles and Sukarno and Margaret Thatcher much later. And like the point is that they had incredible people who were on their flights. So these women had access to interacting with really, you know, a star-studded cast.
And these were in the days of hijackings, which I had kind of just mentally forgotten about, the days when planes used to get hijacked. So, I mean, my point here is just that the level of bravery, in addition to the overlay of everything that you just mentioned, of, you know, flying into Vietnam and the emotional toll that it took to drop soldiers off and pick them up. And maybe you can also talk about another illuminating thing to me, and I don't know why I had kind of forgotten about this, was the baby transport out of Vietnam. I don't know how I had kind of forgotten that happened, but these women were instrumental in that, this Operation Baby Lift. And if you can just mention that for a moment, because there were a lot of surprises in these pages that were so great.
So yeah, I wound up finding that three women who had a lot, who flew a lot of Vietnam flights by nature of living in LA. LA was where Pan Am tended to base its war flights, which were shared by a lot of different American airlines. Pan Am was not the only airline that ran flights out of Vietnam and carried American troops into the war. A lot of different airlines did, but Pan Am flew a large amount of them. And Pan Am was also made a big deal out of it on a PR level, in part because Pan Am had contributed to American war efforts in the past. I found myself really interested in the contrast between the public perception of the job of stewardess, especially a Pan Am stewardess with this glamour and, you know, international mystique, and then the reality of it, which a lot of the women had no idea that they were going to be, that if they wanted to live on the West Coast and fly for Pan Am, they were probably going to be assigned to fly troops in and out of Vietnam. So they had not really known that. And when they were, you know, called upon to do it, they all had very different reactions and very different, you know, emotional and intellectual responses to it. So as I was talking to a number of the women who had crewed on these war flights before, I found myself really drawn toward the stories of a number of them who had in fact been on this really historic orphan baby lift flight in 1975, which was a really controversial flight. The children who were flown out of Vietnam, not all of them were in fact orphans. At first, they were intended to be all orphans, but you know, the end of a really brutal war, there was so much fear on the ground in Saigon. And, you know, a lot of parents or, you know, people who had been taking care of children through the war. And at the end of the war, children of refugees were just put on this plane. It was unbelievable chaos. And the chaos extended to the women who crewed the flights as well. They were told it was, I won't give everything away, but there were the circumstances that led to their being reassigned on, they were on an around the world flight. They were in Hong Kong, planning to fly back to LA the next day. And they were told that they were going to be flying into an active war zone where the plane had just crashed the day before. And the Viet Cong was suspected in that crash. And they were just assigned on this orphan flight. They were just told that they were going to pick up a couple hundred children who needed evacuation. And I was just so incredibly impressed by the fact that these women just all said yes. They said, of course, let's do it. And the amount of bravery and general fortitude that I think that decision reflects was really stunning to me.
Age has to help, right? You do things when you're 25 that you would not do when you're...
Absolutely. Yes. They definitely, the in general, when I talk to people about their war experiences, they would just say, well, you know, you're invincible at 24. And, you know, what was interesting is that a lot of the women, the three women whose stories kind of form the backbone of Come Play the World, were actually not that young when the orphan baby lift happened. They were in their mid-30s at that point. They'd been flying for quite some time. I think Lynn was in her late 20s, but the others, Karen was about 35 then, and as was Tori. So, you know, Tori was like, I think 31. Anyway, they, you know, their youth was not quite as pronounced, but I definitely heard crazy stories from people who had been, you know, come under mortar fire on the runway somewhere in Vietnam. And when I asked them what their internal monologue was and like when the next time they were assigned a war flight, what they thought, they were like, well, it just never occurred to me that it would happen again. I was 23. It just never occurred to me that I would be in any danger, and which I think is hilarious.
Right. Ah, youth.
No.
You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Julia Cook. The book we are talking about is Come Fly the World, about mid-20th century Pan Am stewardesses back then. The book was so personal to me because my dad was in Vietnam and, you know, obviously my mom was flying and he flew when he got back. And so it was dredging up all of these memories. And I've always had this theory that there's a pendulum effect between parents and their children. And having been raised by two parents who just weren't physically around very much because they were both gone, you know, I was so keen to be close at home to raise children. So it is interesting. I don't know, the push and pull of women's choices. And this book just got me reflecting on that quite a bit too, the generational pull between women's choices. But it was such an exciting time, such a glamorous time. I mean, my mom used to take me on the flights and dress me up as a flight attendant and, you know, in her little uniforms. I was
That's
little.
So cute.
Yeah. Yeah. It was the heyday of flying, right? You really had to get dressed up. It was a big deal. Yeah. It was just such a different time and such fun. So thank you for the memories.
Oh, good. Well, and I'll say, you know, as someone who was also, an airline brat too, but in the 80s and 90s, and we also still got dressed up to fly for sure. So,
Well, you had to, especially if you were flying standby, you definitely had to get dressed up. Yes.
Exactly. To your point about women's choices, I think that you're kind of touching on something that really, that I found, I was so struck by over the years that I spent talking to these women and going to, you know, their conferences and their social events and, you know, being a fly on the wall in so many different circumstances. I was so impressed that this group of women in their 70s who had still, they'd forged these incredible friendships that had lasted their whole lives. And yet the lives that they led were so different. You know, some married, some never did, some had children, some didn't. Some would self-identify as feminists, some would not. Some had really high powered careers. Some stayed in flight service for 40 more years. Some stayed home with their kids. The list goes on. So I really liked that the diversity of their experiences didn't, you know, it only seemed to enrich their relationships with one another, because the bedrock of those friendships really was this experience of being out in the world and this commitment to internationalism and to getting out there.
Yeah, and it really was the first time women had any sort of opportunity like that. I mean, actually, the first time anybody in the world had any opportunity like that, because flight was pretty new. But yeah, I mean, it offered such a path out and a path up and out. No pun intended. I guess the pun's partially intended. But I mean, it kind of made sense that that career collided with the ascension of feminism, because, you know, they do feel a little bit hand in hand, even if we look back at that career with some sort of, you know, sexist stereotypes. And I just love this book blew those really out of the water. And yet it really got to all the fun that these women were having. I mean, they were dating all these men. They were going to all these parties. They were partying. They were, I mean, there was some line in here about Playboy bunnies were jealous of the sex that the flight attendants were having.
Yes. Because some of them, you know, some of them really did take advantage of this new sexual freedom, and some of them really truly did not. They experienced the world so differently. And, you know, what I came to really acutely understand the degree to which just, you know, their embrace of these parties or dating or not dating or anything else, you know, it's going to be held against women no matter what you do. So,
right. Good point. So would this have been the job for you back in the day? Had you been born 50 years earlier, would you have been?
Oh, I think it would have been great fun. Yeah. It's funny. I think it would have been great fun, but I do think that I'm a bit too much of a contrarian for it. I probably would have gotten into trouble at some point or another. I talked with one stewardess who only lasted 3 or 4 years, not because she didn't love the work, but because she just kept speaking her mind to too many passengers and talking back in a way that management did not appreciate. But beyond that, I think I probably wouldn't have minded as much. You know, a lot of the appeal of being a stewardess was the fact that you didn't necessarily have to break ranks with the conventions of the time, especially in the 50s and 60s, less so in the 70s. In the 70s, it was much more about embracing these new freedoms that had now become, had made their way through society a little bit more. But in the 50s in particular, there were really not very many ways for women to travel the world alone in a way that was socially acceptable among any group of people. Stewardessing was really kind of it. So I think it would be hard. It's hard for me to imagine what I would do faced with those constraints, because obviously I haven't been raised with those constraints.
I applied to be a flight attendant. Can you believe it?
Awesome.
You don't know me, so you probably would believe it. But so after college, I didn't know what to do because I'd majored in philosophy and I wasn't quite ready to go to law school, which is what I eventually did. And then, my dad got me an interview with Continental, which is who he was flying for at the time. And I showed up to the interview and it's just all these women looking glamorous. This is the 90s. So this was a different time. And I was like, this is not going to work out. So during the interview, the woman said, you know, what are you doing here? And I said, you know, my mom was a flight attendant, whatever. And she said, you're just putting off grad school. I said, that's true. That's exactly what I'm doing. She's like, you're not getting this job. I said,
okay. Even though in reality, like, tons of the women who had been flying in the 60s and 70s were essentially putting off grad school. You know, they didn't know it at the time, but, you know, they flew for 5 years and then went and got MBAs once they weren't like the only woman, you know, walking through those halls. There were maybe five other women among the you know, however many men. So, you know, they didn't realize it, but they were just putting off grad school too. So you would have been in really good company.
I mean, it really is a testament to how much that industry changed, because, you know, in the 90s, you were expected to stay until you were 60. And in the 50s, you were expected to stay until you were 30, right? So they wanted women who were, you know, in theory, going to stick around to make their training dollars worthwhile. Whereas before, I think women were just lining up to do this. So
no, that's so true.
Well, shifting over to the crafty questions of this, talk about at the point at which, when you went into the project, did you know it would have the legs to sustain a book length project, or where in the research and interview process did you come to understand, yes, this is a whole 200 plus page book as opposed to a really interesting article?
I think at the beginning, I think I knew that there would be enough stories to sustain a book length project, or at least I hoped that there would be. My instinct told me that there would be. And it was just a matter of finding them, then putting in the time and figuring out how to contextualize them, how to draw in, you know, the bigger currents that would prove their relevance on a wider scale. You know, I think a lot of the individual stories and anecdotes would have made for really good stories. And in fact, there are so many incredible anecdotes that I had to cut out of the book for space. There are so many incredible people whose stories had to be, you know, compressed down into just a couple of paragraphs of like almost, you know, not quite an aside, but something between an aside and something to focus on within the book. So, you know, that was kind of heartbreaking on some level, because a lot of those different stories were really illustrative of other aspects of the era or other aspects of the job. They just didn't necessarily work as well in, you know, in the structure of the book and what I was eventually focusing on. But the wealth of stories and the richness of them made me think from the beginning that it could be a book. I just had to figure out how to make it a book.
So let's talk about that, and talking about kind of crafting the shape and structure of it, and, you know, the chapters that it became. And so you, I assume, well, I don't know, but you did all of this research. You talked to all of these women. You had kind of a wealth of material. And then talk about that process of shaping it down and trying to, you know, as you say, contextualize it and figure out how to unspool the thread of the whole book.
My editor, I have a really wonderful editor at Houghton Mifflin. She really was instrumental to that. The first draft that I gave her was quite a fair bit longer than what you read. And it included a lot of those anecdotes that I wound up having to cut out. She really pushed me to think about, to assess what I was saying within the context of how it impacted each individual person and what it could tell us about each of the people that I focused on. And she encouraged me also to try to, I had written an initial draft that was very strictly strictly chronologically ordered. And, you know, the chronology in what you read is nearly entirely chronological as well, but it's a little bit less strict about, you know, you learn this one piece of information before learning this next piece of information that happened after that. There's a little bit of back and forth in it that's signaled that, you know, the reader is told about. So, you know, I didn't mess with the timing of anything, but I did mess with when the reader would find out about it. So that was really helpful too, to kind of think about how to get the reader invested in the characters before, you know, right up front.
The fun part about it is that, yes, so you're invested in the characters, but you're also invested in, like I say, the events of the day. And so, you know, I mean, Vietnam keeps appearing over and over in different chapters, but in different contexts, and the women's stories unspool. So I thought, yeah, it would be a challenge to have, you know, do you just follow one woman's storyline, which would have been one way to do it? Or do you, you know, follow the geopolitical events as they happen and then how the women come in and out of those, which is kind of also what you did. And then you follow, I mean, so you managed to accomplish following character, following theme, following trends, following, you know, I guess chronology kind of gives you that, but not entirely. So I just thought that the structure of this was really clever and would have been hard for me to come up with, but once I read it, you know, seemed clear. But I thought from a writer's perspective, it was probably a pretty big challenge.
It was. I use a lot of Post-its and I cut things out a lot and I paste them. I have a giant white wall in my office and, you know, it's kind of at this point looking pretty icky because it's kind of covered in shards of tape, because I print things out and then I color code them and I tape them up on the wall so that I have a sense of what the reader is understanding when and how many pages are going to go by between this character's appearance and this character's next appearance. Because I find that without having the color coding is really important for me. That's just how I think pretty visually in that regard. So that it's a system that that I learned over the course of writing this book really works for me. And it's interesting, as I'm thinking about writing a next book, I'm already starting to structure it in my brain, these, you know, color-coded chunks and these Post-its, and it's coming together a lot more quickly structurally than I thought it, than this one did, certainly.
That's good, because when you can apply something from a last project to the next one, that's bonus points there. So the colors correspond to characters and to theme, or tell me about what the colors represent.
So I've done it both ways. You know, in this book, it was primarily the colors were corresponding to characters. And then I would kind of write in the margins. I print things out 4 pages to a page so that I can print out the whole book on, like, you know, 80 pages.
Yeah. Okay.
And then I just go through and kind of, and each character gets a different colored pencil color. And I you know, swab out that whole page with the color. And then anything that is just thematic and not connected to a character stays white. And then I'll write what that's about in the margins. And then I put it up on the wall. And so I can see, you know, here's where you find out about Vietnam, and you find it out via Karen. And then here's where Vietnam Next pops up, and it's happening via Lynn. Okay, so what does that mean for the next time it pops up? I haven't told anyone how Claire felt about that, so let's look at that. So it helps me to understand how the theme and character are overlapping.
Was voice tricky? Do you write kind of in the same voice throughout all of your work, and that's kind of set in stone? Or did you let some of these women's voices into your head to influence the voice of the book?
I honestly don't know. What do you think? I mean, did you feel a difference between, Lynn and Karen and Tori, for example? I have now spent them and writing about them.
That's what I was trying to figure out for myself, is was it a matter of details or was it a matter of voice? And I think the voice was pretty consistent throughout the whole book. So I didn't notice a switch in voice, but I definitely knew when we were with Karen versus when we were with Tori. But I think that's because of who the women were and not who the voice was. But I couldn't tell if that's how you felt about it too.
No, that's how I think I feel about it. You're right that the details, what each of them talks about and how each of them talks about their lives, and the, you know, the things that they told me about themselves, were, it was all very different. And, you know, I was really lucky that I had both Karen and Lynn had saved the letters that they had sent home to their parents from all of these years. So which they, you know, FedExed to me years ago at this point. So not only was there a difference between my voice or what I think or what I was considering and what they were telling me, but there was also a difference, at least in their two cases, between them in the past and them today.
Sure.
So yeah. That was really, really, really wonderful.
I wonder if it changed their minds about their experiences in digesting it 40, 50 years later, you know, if they felt the same.
Yeah, it was really interesting. Lynn in particular, she gave me her letters and she said, look, I've just read all of these. Please understand that I was so sleep deprived. She's like, I'm realizing that, you know, I sent these letters to my parents and I there are things that I put down here that, you know, I know happened, but my memories of them are different from what's on paper. And I don't know whether that's the passing of time or whether that's the fact that, you know, I was writing these letters to my mom in the bathroom while my roommate slept, you know, when I couldn't sleep because I was on, you know, New York time and I was in Beirut. So, you know, take these with a grain of salt.
That's the other thing about that job is you have to get, I mean, the time zone changes are so hard on your body. So I'm always amazed by women who can do this for so long, because I mean, not only is it a taxing physical job, it's very physical, but it's also switching time zones over and over, and you never fly the same, you know, month to month, your routes change, and yeah, it's just exhausting.
Totally.
No wonder my
mom
was
exhausting.
No wonder she was hard to grow up with.
I mean, I think it was interesting. It really, the job itself impacted the relationships that people had around the job, in part because, you know, I heard stories about how, you know, the women would come back from their jobs and their spouses, boyfriends at first, or, you know, significant others, roommates, would want to do things with them when they got back, and they were just exhausted. All they wanted to do was sleep, or, you know, sit still in an armchair and stare at a wall.
Totally.
And it had its impact.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's funny because we never went anywhere when I was a kid. We never traveled anywhere because the last thing they wanted to do was fly. So people always said, oh, you must have gone all over the place with these passes. I was like, nope, we just stayed home because
That's so interesting.
They were 100% uninterested in travel. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think about how your mom must have experienced the different places that she went to and the way that was transmitted to you. Did she ever talk about her trips with you when she was back home?
Well, the interesting thing was both of them flew for pretty regional airlines. So they were really confined to the West Coast. So mm-hmm. I mean, she loved it. She loved everything about it, but it was not this experience. You know, she definitely was not flying international like these women. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a shame in some ways, and others, I think if she was flying more than she already was, it would have been really even more difficult, you know, on a kid.
The exhaustion. Yeah, for sure.
Tell me a little bit about, because I know it wasn't just a matter of interviewing these women, it was a lot of research behind it. And so tell me a little bit about that process. The notes section at the back of the book indicates how much research you did, and I'm sure you had to fact check everything they said. So kind of knowing when you were done, when you'd had enough, and a little bit about the stories behind the interviews.
Yeah. So my process for research was really, I let the interviews with the women and the oral history that I was collecting from the different people that I was interviewing, I let those stories guide the research at first. I would move between talking and an interview with a woman that brought up a scene that I found really interesting. And then I would go and look up what the New York Times had written about, you know, for example, Tori gets caught in this diplomatic kidnapping in Ghana. And she told me about that. I found it fascinating, almost unbelievable. And then I went and looked it up and I found tons of articles about this one incident that it talked about, you know, the 19 diplomats who've been kidnapped off this plane. And, you know, obviously there's no mention of the flight crew. So then I went back and talked to her again and said, look, I found this article. This is what they said. What else can you tell me? And my questions for her became more pointed. And then again, you know, she told me more. And then I went and found, you know, some cables that were declassified from the government, some government information about the same thing, about the, you know, the diplomatic side of it. And then, you know, I would talk to other people who'd been on the same flight and get it from their perspective and ask them what happened. The research was really, you know, I used primary sources like letters and government information. And then I used newspapers, a lot of newspapers and archival information from the Pan Am Archive down in Miami. And then also a lot of academic books about a huge variety of subjects from, you know, the diplomatic relationships between newly decolonized African nations of the time. And then, you know, from that kind of subject to what LA was like in the 70s, the subcultures there. And things like Karen, who was her first job was on an army base in West Germany. So, you know, what were the West German U.S. army bases like? So I did a lot of reading in a lot of different areas to kind of back up what I was learning from the women.
I'm glad you brought up that incident about the diplomatic kidnapping, because I was thinking, you know, the Vietnam War and feminism were somewhat foreseeable given the time period we're in. But some of these other world events and cultural events were really surprising. And so I imagine there were a lot of those that popped up during these stories, but that's the one that hit me the most. I was like, oh, you know, I just forgotten about that. And that you happened to run into the woman who was on that plane. But I guess so many things were happening. As you say, movie stars and diplomats and executives were getting on these planes. So I love the phrase of every plane was its own. I forget how you said it, but every plane is its own mini history or is its own microcosm of what was going on at those times. And there must have been a lot of those surprises along the way in this research.
There were a ton of them, you know, and it's interesting because each woman had her own kind of specific flavor, you know, just that was shaped by it. Well, so let's say each woman's experience of the world through these years that I was focusing on has a very different tone, if that makes sense. Tori was really interested in diplomacy. She had wanted to be a diplomat. And so, you know, the flights that just by nature of the flight routes that she would ask for, a lot of what she did wound up bumping into what I would call a diplomatic history or, you know, world events like these countries, whether it's Cold War history or, you know, American culture, American history. She really, she took a great amount of pride from the Vietnam flights that she participated in. She really loved flying soldiers back and forth and feeling like she was contributing in a way to their experiences of a really harrowing war. She really enjoyed being able to, what she would have described perhaps as boost their spirits. So, and then, you know, someone else, Lynn, on the other hand, was really wound up getting involved in the Vietnam War protest movement. And so her experience and the flight routes that she wound up bidding were different. And she also wound up on these Vietnam flights, but her experience of them was very different by nature of what her involvement in, you know, the different movements of the era was. So there were tons of surprises, and the women's experiences of the same flight routes were totally different.
Well, Tori, we should say, was Norwegian.
Yes, right. She was.
And I think went to work for the UN at some point.
She tried to volunteer for the UN. Yeah, yeah, she did volunteer for a little bit when she first moved to New York. She moved to New York when she was about 22, when she started working for Pan Am. She had really wanted to be in the Norwegian Foreign Service, and she had worked for NATO in college and for the French embassy in Norway. And she really wanted a career in the diplomatic corps, but she'd been told that women needed to have a master's degree in order to apply for the diplomatic corps. So she knew that, you know, her parents couldn't afford to keep her afloat for the amount of, and to pay for a master's degree for the amount of time that would require. She needed to get a job. So she applied for Pan Am thinking that it would be just a couple years and then she'd go back home and work for NATO. And of all the women in the book, she had the longest career in flight service, actually. So, you know, she moved to New York and wanted to volunteer for the UN, but was really not put to work. She was never assigned to do anything other than stuff envelopes. So she really tired of that pretty quickly and thought, and I'm sure with the experiences that she was having on these really consequential flights, she just was thinking, why am I wasting my time stuffing envelopes when I'm, you know, having conversations with diplomats on these flights, when I'm enacting diplomacy in a way, you know, in the air.
Right. Well, and it just strikes me that it would be interesting to have her perspective, not as an American, right, coming to it from a different cultural perspective. And I have no idea where feminism and other issues were in Norway at that period of time. But yeah, just, you know, it was just such a different, fun perspective. As you say, all these women came to it from such different places.
And it's interesting because her perspective on the Vietnam War was very different from the American women's, in part because of Norway's, the way that NATO had impacted Norway in World War II and afterwards in the immediate post-war period with the USSR ascendant. So she really sensed, she had a deep sense of, when I interviewed her about the Vietnam War, she just kept coming back to SEATO, the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, and the U.S.'s commitment to that organization.
So do these projects kind of feed the next project? Or, you know, as you're doing research, do you garner ideas for what you want to do next? Or are they totally independent of each other?
No, this project has a lot to, it has a lot of intellectual overlap with what I'm thinking about doing next. I think I'm really interested in the way that we look at history and how, especially women's history in particular, I feel like there are so many different pockets of history that are not really, you know, where women's experiences have been minimized and kind of pushed to the side. And I don't think I think there's a lot of really fruitful terrain to mine.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, there is. Indeed, there is. Is there other writing advice, craft advice, journalism advice that we should have talked about that we left out that has sustained you or that would help others?
You know, in grad school, I was just told to read a lot, that the more you read, the better you write. And I think that's true. But I also, over the last 5 or 7 years or so, I've been involved in a group of people who write daily. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've signed up for various iterations of this group. And, you know, it's a month by month thing. It's not necessarily, you know, I very often don't do it in December, for example, because of the holidays and family commitments. But for the most part, getting into the practice of writing every day, even if it's just, you know, a paragraph or a line or anything, just taking note of what's around me or what I'm reading, that has been a life-changing and career-changing experience for me. It's really, and it's also helped keep me sane in times, you know, like the pandemic when I have been unable to travel. I spend every day with my toddler. and there are days when I forget that I what I would consider my real life is like. And so to have that kind of practice of just taking a moment and reflecting on something or you know, trying to turn a phrase or making an observation into, you know, putting it down on paper, that's been really sustaining.
Absolutely. I just started that myself. I've only been at it for like 3 weeks or something, but yeah, it is. It's totally life-changing, career-changing when, you know, we have to sit down for 2 hours every morning and really not supposed to get up. And it's good. It's good. And
That's
I don't know
great.
Why that accountability makes a difference, but it does. It makes a difference. So.
Well, and it also, you know, remember that Graham Greene famously only ever wrote 500 words a day. It doesn't have to be long. That's been what's been so freeing about doing this daily practice type thing, that it doesn't, I no longer really put pressure on myself to do the amount of work that, you know, I would like to be doing, but that my life doesn't always necessarily accommodate. But that doesn't mean that I shouldn't write something, you know? And then all of those somethings do wind up adding up.
No, they absolutely
do. They really do.
No, it's surprising. Surprising how much zero adds up to zero and how much five adds up over time.
Exactly. Yes,
and you have a website. I think it's just your name, juliacook.com. Cook has an E at the end of it.
Yes.
Right. Perfect. Are there other ways we can follow you, find you? I know you're going to do a great book tour in March. So I assume all of those events are going to be up on your website.
those events will be up on my website. The book also has a website, which is just comeflytheworld.com. And so those events will also be up there. I have an Instagram and a Twitter handles, both of which are Julia C. Cook. And yeah, that's how to find me.
We can't miss you. I love it.
Yeah, it's pretty easy.
Well, thank you for the trip around the world. This was much needed during these pandemic times. And the trip down memory lane for me was really great. Such
thank
a great
you.
Book.
Thank
congratulations.
You for sharing your memories.
That was Julia Cook. The book Come Fly the World is out and available now, published by Houghton Mifflin. That's all the time we have for today. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, have a great day.